podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
Hello, welcome to the Snooker Scene Podcast. I'm Dave Hendon.
And I'm Michael McMullen.
I'm not sure we even got the start of that. I'm not sure we were recording. I'll just repeat it. I'm Dave Hendon, you're Michael McMullen, and this is the Snooker Scene Podcast. What a great start to the show.
Can only get better.
Well, let's hope so. Well, one thing that you can look forward to later on, at the end of our chat, I'll be speaking to Wayne Griffiths, that's Terry's son, about their new snooker handicap project, Snooker Quotient. So that'll be at the end of our little bit. Now, the facts are these, OK? We've only had one email all week, which leads me to one conclusion. The show's in crisis. We're going to have to inject something into it, because clearly people are saying, look, you boasted last week about being big in Finland. Well, you know, where's all the interest this week? I know what it was. I made fun of Vanilla Ice, and there's clearly been a backlash.
So there's that. And also, you know, the Finns have been playing in the Euros, their first ever tournament, so they've got other things to be doing. We can understand that. They can have the summer, you know.
Well, but the one email we did get is absolutely superb, because it comes from Matt Tresco, and this is what he says. He says, greetings from sunny Manchester. Because I'm badly in need of a hobby, I've been spending time working on a Masters Almanac, something in a similar vein to Chris Downer's Crucible Almanac. It's still a work in progress, but it's reached a point where I think it contains enough information to be of interest to some of your listeners. It has full match and frame scores, played, won, lost stats, century breaks, most frequent head-to-head matchups, and a host of miscellaneous facts and tidbits that are probably best forgotten. I've attached a copy. If your listeners are interested, I've set up a blog spot so I can download, host a download link. So this is the address to access it. I did put it on Twitter earlier on, and a lot of people have already looked at it. But the address is mastersalmanac.blogspot.com. That's I told you it was no good this week. Okay, mastersalmanac.blogspot.com.
Just direct people to your Twitter page. They'll see it there.
Well, yeah, I notice he says, Matt Tresco, this is, he says, I think it contains enough information to be of interest. Well, it's 113 pages, and I can tell you it is absolutely extraordinary. It's a fantastic piece of work, very much in the vein of Chris Downer's Crucible Almanac. All the scores are there, you know, all the breaks are there. There is actually, Matt points out, there's a sort of page of omissions, there's a few things he's still after. So if you go on there, his email address is on there. If you've got any of the gaps that can be filled, he would like to do that. But, well, you've looked at it. What do you think?
Well, first of all, I've really got to get this out of the way. So Matt Tresco has sent the only email, but we do appreciate that he sent it in anyway, because it's a case of Tresco, every little helps.
Wow.
Yeah, that's going to get down well in Finland, isn't it? Anyway, now that we've got that silliness out of the way, I'm going to make an enormous statement, and this podcast has been home to many of those over the years. This could be the biggest. I reckon he's out Chris Downer to Chris Downer. With this.
Big talk.
Yeah, big, massive talk. I mean, so many favourites here. One of them is the fact that there was a quarterfinal in 1976, was it, between Ray Reardon, who would have been world champion at the time, and John Pulman, who was a former world champion, in which the highest break was 22.
Yes. Well, I was thinking about that. Like, was that brown to black? Was it?
Probably.
Did someone get in? Because when you think about it, like, and this is, what, a best of nine frame, match best of seven, best of nine, whatever it was. Like, 22, like, early in a frame, that's basically seven or eight pots. So are we saying only once in the match did someone manage to string together?
They are.
Two multi-world champions, by the way. I mean, what was it? Clive had a nice phrase for it, if I could just find it.
For connoisseurs of the ghastly.
That's it, yeah. That was in Snooker Scene. Yeah, I mean, it does sound awful. But
But some of the other things as well. I mean, this was news to me. I don't know if you knew this. I knew this kind of carry on used to go on back in the 1940s or 50s or whatever. But apparently, up to, I think he said 1984, they used to play the dead frames. I mean, that's just beyond belief.
Yeah, well, basically, it's worth saying that, of course, the Masters in those days, it was an independent promotion, so it wasn't a WPBC event, so they could basically do what they wanted. And, yeah, it says here, sessions finished early, it was common practice to fill out the time playing the dead frames, although these did not count towards the final scores, and, of course, neither the high break. So, for example, 1981, Doug Mountjoy beat Eddie Charlton 5-0. He made a break of 1-3-7, but the high break was made in the tournament by Terry Griffiths, 1-3-6. It looks like Barry Hearn put play to this. He says here, in 1984, Barry Hearn announced the Matrim players would no longer play out the dead frames. So Davies beat Mio 5-0. They didn't play the dead frames. The practice fell out of fashion. It doesn't bear thinking about that, really, now, does it? I mean, talk about anti-climax as well for for the audience because it means nothing.
And what if someone had made a 147 in one of the dead frames? Like, would that have counted towards the official records? It seems amazing. But there's so much gold in this almanac. I mean, the fact that apparently once during the tournament there was a pro-celebrity match. Mm. I can't remember who the pros were, but the celebrities were Peter Alice and Eric Seitz, who always seems to pop up in these things, by the way. And, I mean, what else can you point to? Also, I was fascinated to see there have been four matches that have gone to a respot in the final frame. Now, you consider, I think there's only ever been one at the Crucible. It seems remarkable that there have been four there. So it's absolutely fantastic. And now, of course, Dave, as you would put it, all we need is a UK championship version, and then we'll have the triple crown of almanacs.
Well, that would be an extraordinary trilogy, wouldn't it? Because And it would be a big tome if you actually printed it all out. That would be because the Crucible one is over 300 pages. This is over 100. That the UK, I think, would sit somewhere in the middle, probably about 200. Mm. So that would be a lot of stuff to pull through. Bringing it on, I say. Some great stuff in here, actually. I mean, my favourite, scrolling through, my favourite one is just called Fowlathon. It's just one paragraph. It says Mark Wildman's first four shots on his debut match in the 1983 Masters were all fouls. Fantastic.
I tell you what, it's a real shame, just on a slight, diversion, that Mark lives in Spain and we never see him anymore, because he would have been brilliant to have on the podcast. Yeah. One of the brilliant raconteurs and storytellers, and someone who, he had a career outside of snooker as well, didn't he? Because he worked in a bank. I think he was only a full-time professional for a few years, so he kind of was able to look at it all from a slightly outsider's point of view. It would be wonderful to get Mark on, actually. Maybe we'll go to Spain and do it. How about that? You do that live show there.
Yeah, another one. A double re-rack, okay? The first double re-rack, not just in the Masters, but in professional tournament play, happened in the sixth frame of the first round match between Neil Foulds and Dennis Taylor in 1987. After two abandoned attempts of 13 and 7 minutes duration, Taylor eventually claimed the frame with a break of 101. And also, there's a reference here. You talk about the pro celebrity billiards. So 1977, which is quite early on, obviously, in the Masters run, they played an experimental billiards tournament. And Alex Higgins, it turned out, was supposed to play, but misread the time. So he
surprised.
Didn't show up. It ended up, it says here, final between Rex Williams and Fred Davis. Williams won with a break of 209 and finished. And then it just says, television reaction was unenthusiastic and the tournament was not repeated.
Wow. I think that's the last line on the descriptions of most billiards events that have appeared on television over the years. I mean, look, all these stories are absolutely wonderful. And it must have taken him so much time. I suspect he may have ploughed through many, many back issues of Snooker Scene. But also, go on, yeah.
No, just to jump in, because that's actually quite an important point. This and the Crucible Almanac, and indeed I think Ron Flores would accept Q Tracker. Mm. They do show up the value of Snooker Scene, the sort of contribution that Clive has made in the pre-internet era, in terms of preserving the sport's history, all the frame scores, all the results, quotes he's put in from various things, little quirky things as well. It's all come from that, and obviously things changed when the internet came in and there was more easier ways of getting this information. But prior to about 20 years ago, really, the prime source outside of newspapers, and even they wouldn't run frame scores, was Snooker Scene. And that, in some ways, is one of Clive's, well, possibly his greatest contribution to the sport. He's just preserving the history of the game. So guys like Matt and Chris and Ron can then take it on and put it out there in another way.
What's that phrase he always uses, that he wanted to create a rolling wisdom? Wisdom, of course, being the cricket annual, just for anyone who doesn't know that. And this underlines it. But what I was going to say is, I mean, some of the stats are also wonderful that he's obviously taken a huge amount of time to put together. And some of them are, you know them, or at least you would know them if you thought about them. But then you see them on paper and you think, wow, that's actually, I hadn't thought of it like that. One of them, I think, was that Jimmy White has been in something like, is it 14 semifinals and only won two of them? There was some incredible stuff.
And Ron, well, I think Ronnie is the opposite. I think he's been in 14 semis and only lost one.
Yes, that's right. And even that, when I was looking at the list of most finals. Now, if someone had said to me, how many Masters finals has Ronnie O'Sullivan been? Obviously, give me a couple of minutes. I'll think through them and I'll tell you it's 13. But I'd never actually thought about that. When you do consider it, when you take into account that the Masters is always playing top players, to get to the final of it 13 times. And he hasn't even played in it every year. I think it was a year or two he opted out of it. So it's only when you see it written down like that that you think, what an incredible achievement that actually is.
Well, of course, he opted out of it 2020, didn't he? And he said, at the time, he was doing that fist bumping. He said, if you shake hands, you can get germs. And he said,
that's right.
He said, Alexandra Palace is a bit of a sick building. He said, I always seem to get ill here. And everyone at the time took the mickey. Oh, there's Ronnie doing his thing. He won't shake hands. All of a sudden, only a few months later, there's a pandemic and no one's shaking hands. One thing I just wanted to just to close on this, and I'll give the address out again if I can get my teeth together so people can access it, because it is free. You can download it for free. But he very interestingly charts the sort of status of the Masters. Now, as early as 1978, Clive Everton in snooker scene was saying it feels like the game's second biggest tournament. Of course, in those days, though, there are only four or five events.
Yeah.
And Matt makes the point that in the 80s, when the big ranking events came along, and let's mention it, the Mercantile Classic, British Open, Grand Prix, all those sort of events, the Masters wasn't actually regarded as the second biggest. Mm. Steve Davis is quoted here as saying that he won it 88. I think he lost the year before, and he said, to be honest, I don't feel I put as much effort into this event as ranking tournaments. He targeted... Yeah. Ranking tournament. But over the years, because it was a constant on the circuit and some of those other events started to fall away, and also the money went up, there was a general feeling it became more prestigious. And I think now, well, I'll give my opinion. To me, it is the second biggest tournament now. I think a lot of people feel that. It has huge prestige. In normal times, it's played in front of that big London crowd. Going to Alexandra Palace after all these at Wembley, you know, it is a good venue. It's that slot as well, the first tournament of the calendar year in the new year in January. But it wasn't always like that. It started at quite a high level because there weren't many events. Maybe fell a little bit behind, but then recovered, I think, probably from the 90s onwards. And now I think everyone agrees it is a great, great event.
Cliff Thorburn said this is the big daddy now after the World Championship. But to be fair, let's say he was biased because he'd won it three times in four years. Of course he was going to say that. Interestingly, what you're saying about Ronnie, you know, that he didn't want to go there in 2020 for the reason you outlined. Well, it seems remarkable he said that before the whole COVID thing hit. Then we're in the middle of COVID and he hugs Rob Walker in the middle of the Crucible Arena. So contradictory as ever, Ronnie. But it's an absolutely amazing piece of work. Absolutely hats off to it. And if you're the sort of person who listens to this podcast, and obviously you are, because otherwise you wouldn't be hearing this now, then this has really got so much for you. And just settle down with it some evening. Absolutely fantastic. And as I say, hats off for taking all the time and effort to do it.
Well, the address is mastersalmanac.blogspot.com, and as I say, there's a few bits of the information that he's still after, so have a look at that if you can help him out. Matt Tresco is your man. His email address is on the link. Now then, we have had a few emails that we haven't been able to get to in recent weeks, so let's go on to James Wan, who writes, and this was during the French Open tennis, so it was a few weeks ago. He said, you may have heard that Roger Federer has pulled out of the French Open in the middle of the tournament. The general reaction was sympathy and well-wishing from officials, fellow players, fans and the press. The important point here is that Roger isn't injured. He just wants to protect aging knees. I know how he feels. He said, this got me thinking. How would Ronnie O'Sullivan have been treated for pulling out for similar reasons? A direct equivalent would be that he wants to protect his aging elbow. I think he'd be thoroughly admonished. People would say he's acting up, disrespectful and being all controversial. Nobody said Roger's behaviour was bizarre, but I'm 99% sure that most headlines would be for Ronnie, snooker star pulls out with bizarre excuse. What do you think? Is Ronnie afforded as much respect as other top sports people in the world? I don't know what to think about this, really, because obviously this is a completely hypothetical situation. The Roger Federer thing, I'm a massive fan of Federer. He's my favourite tennis player by far. But I thought it was slightly out of order, actually, because he'd beaten various people in the tournament. And then he decided, well, I'd like to prioritise Wimbledon, so I'm going to pull out of this event. I don't know how the people he beat felt. But the thing is, because he's never really put a foot wrong, he's always represented himself and his sport immaculately. I suppose because he's never been someone who's been in trouble, he was just treated sort of, okay, Roger, you've earned your right to do what you like sort of thing. In terms of how Ronnie would be, well, we don't know because it hasn't happened. I think if a player, let's just say any player, was injured then and they pull out of an event, then people understand that, you know, that's just unfortunate. I think they get sympathy. I don't think I was thinking about this. I don't know what you think. The only sort of comparison I could think of, and it wasn't an injury, but John Higgins pulled out of the Grand Prix going back over 20 years now.
I think it was 2000. Yeah,
it was in Telford. And he pulled out because he got to the quarterfinals. And his brother was due to get married that day. And he said he had been promised months in advance. He checked it out. I know the Grand Prix is on that week, but just to check, the quarterfinals wouldn't be that day. Or I think there was an issue about would they split them over 2 days or play them on the same day. So either way, he was promised, whatever happens, John, you won't be playing that day. Of course, it came round and he did, and he pulled out. And it was a strange old do that because, you know, you could see both sides. Obviously, you know, his brother had booked that date. He can't, you know, you have to book weddings quite in advance if you want to get a good venue and so on. But equally, you know, the realities of the tour is that things change, formats change and so on. It was just unfortunate, but it was a strange old do. My memory of that was Higgins was treated reasonably well in the media.
Yeah. I think he was best man at the wedding as well. Of course, obviously he would have wanted to be there anyway. The thing was, he actually said that he played a match after saying he was going to pull out. I think, and I could be wrong about this, but off the top of my head, I think it might have been Terry Murphy from Derry who he was playing. And he had said prior to the match, if I win this match, I'm going to pull out of the tournament. So he was very upfront about it. The thing with Ronnie, I mean, you know, it's a very different sport. So, I mean, it wouldn't really be a valid reason, would it, to pull out of an event? But, of course, you know, Ronnie has often pulled out of events in very strange circumstances. And, indeed, one event he entered and pulled out in the middle of a match. And I don't remember him getting particularly hammered for it. So I think it's like all these things, isn't it? You know, it's like you said about Harry and Meghan, you know, after they did that interview. If you're pro-royal, then you're against them and vice versa. And it would be the same with this, you know, with anything with Ronnie. It's like people who are fans of his will defend him no matter what he does. And people who don't like him so much will probably criticise him a bit because it seems to be the way of the world now. Maybe we'll find out someday when... Actually, if Ronnie's listening, it would be just like him to think, oh, that'd be a good idea. I'll pull out saying I need to protect my elbow.
Well, as you say, we may find out. Yeah, the Higgins thing, though, it was bizarre. I remember John Dee, the late John Dee, the journalist, who, because we had a discussion last week about Snooker in the media, he got wind of it, I think, sort of on that afternoon, and he sort of came sidling in. And it was a sort of man of few words, John, in a lot of ways. But he sidled up and he said, Higgins is going to pull out. Higgins is going to pull out. He said, you watch. And we said, okay, yeah, whatever. And then, of course, then he did. Anyway, that all seems a long time ago now. Malcolm Johnston.
As it is.
Yeah, well, that's right, yeah. Malcolm Johnston writes, he said, well, of course, just finally on that, of course, that was pre-social media. So any sort of residual battering he might get from the public was just in the sanctity of their own homes and sort of pubs. It wasn't a public thing. Anyway, Malcolm Johnston, he says, after watching some of the finest snooker I've ever seen over the last year, do you think in years to come we'll be looking back at the tournaments during the tour stay at the Marshall Arena and wonder if it was a high watermark for the sport? I found it quite strange the main benefactor, Judd Trump, seems certain he's better off with a crowd, but my view is it may be the closest any players have to their practice form. Many commentators speak about players always striving to bring their closed-door club practice game to a match table, but haven't we just had that? I know a crowd can make for marvellous tension, and as a regular Alexandra Palace for the Masters, I've seen how much it can affect a player, i.e. Wembo's Blackby O'Sullivan. But for a mainly TV audience, I feel the closed match arena has made the snooker over lockdown peerless. Well, it's certainly true. We saw a very high standard. It did feel on the main table. I mean, you can't really speak for the outside tables because we don't see them, but it did feel sort of laboratory conditions at times. Now, players, I think, do obviously prefer a crowd because it gets you into... you know, a good state of mind, and also it makes it feel like it's important. But yeah, you know, the fact is the standard, once they got their head down and played, the standard was high, and that was really the positive takeaway from the last year. Not only did we get the tournaments on, but we saw some fantastic snooker.
I thought it was an outstanding season, actually. You talk about the quality of play, but also the stories we had, like Jordan Brown, for example. So many deciding frame finishes to finals. I really did think it was an outstanding season. Whether that was because of the unusual circumstances or not, possible to say. And, of course, there was no crowd there, but you still had just as many people. In fact, probably more than usual watching on television. And that's a huge amount of pressure in itself as well. But I do agree with his basic point. I thought it was a wonderful season. And, you know, perhaps sometimes we fall into the trap of always saying at the end of the season, oh, it's been another great year for snooker. But I do think this was one of the best seasons we ever had.
Yeah, and also, of course, they had the applause button. I know someone who was let loose on it, like to have a go at it, and he was sort of otherwise engaged. He sort of turned around to talk to someone, ended up leaning on it. So in the middle of a safety exchange, you had this burst of applause. Anyway, hopefully we'll never have to hear that again, we hope. Now then, I did say earlier, you know, that the show is in some crisis, but I'm going to bring it back now because I'm going to inject something new into it. I say new. It's based on a couple of weeks ago, we had the great Dave Tindall was on the show, and he brought a quiz based on Pot Black Diaries from the 80s, and also his own diary. And we had to, well, if you, it's there to listen to if you want to go back over that. Well, I have in my hand here, okay, the programme for the 1993 World Championship. Of course,
oh,
I do.
Oh, my word.
It fell out of a cupboard the other day, and of course, as you do, I started flicking through it. And in this year, they did obviously profiles of all the players, but they also did a little questionnaire, okay, asking players their favourite things. So I thought, obviously, this is a one-sided quiz because I have all the answers. I thought I would ask you if you could name some of the players from some of the clues I'm going to give you, okay?
Right. So long as I'm not accused of cheating this time like I was in the last one.
let it go. you still won. Okay, so I'm, yeah. So obviously the top 16 this is from 1993.
Can I just say, I'm glad you said top 16, because some of the qualifiers that year were people like John Giles, Sean Mellish.
Yeah.
I mean, there were some real obscure names there. Spencer Dunn, that was the other one I was trying to think of. Carl Payne. So I'm very glad you said top 16. 15 of whom, by the way, won their first round match.
Indeed, yeah. I think, was it Doug Mountjoy was the one who
yeah, he beat Robert. The first 15 matches to finish all went to the seeds. It would have been an entirely seeded last 16, but for Doug winning that match. Anyway, we digress.
Well, I'll just describe the programme, Embassy programme. £3, by the way. I don't know if that one seems a lot of money in 1993. Stephen Hendry's on the front. Of course, he beat Jimmy White in one of the all-time classics the year before. We got a welcome message from the Imperial Tobacco man, John Spence, who was chairman. In fact, it says here, £1 million is another milestone. So that was the first year where they had £1 million first prize. But anyway, so the top 16, obviously I'm not going to say they are, but you know, a lot of people will sort of remember them as we go. So I'm going to read three clues for each one, okay? Play along at home. No wagering, please. It's all for fun. So the first player, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Favorite food, chips. Favorite TV program, he just says sport.
Word. Yeah.
Favorite music, Dire Straits. So that we got chips, favorite TV program, sport, and favorite music, Dire Straits.
It's funny, I actually have this program sitting in the next room. I'm very tempted to go and guess, but I'm going to guess Jimmy.
It's not right. No, I'll give you another clue. I'm not sure you're going to get it from this.
I know Jimmy liked his chips in those days, but yeah.
Hobbies, golf. That doesn't really narrow it down, does it?
Yeah, no, that's no help whatsoever.
It's Terry Griffiths, is the answer.
Really?
Yeah. Okay. Dire Straits, that time, or maybe just before that time, that was kind of the stock answer for a lot of snooker players for favourite music. It's a bit like now, if you ask a favourite film of a snooker player, they say The Shawshank Redemption.
Yeah,
even though it's clearly not the right answer. Anyway, we'll move on. So that's yet to score, but there's still time.
The idea that there could be a right answer to that question. I mean, surely it is the right answer if they're asked what their favourite film is.
No, the
question is not what is David Hendon's favourite film.
Well, The Shawshank Redemption is not the best film ever. It's the answer sports people give to the question, what's the best film ever? My advice, watch more films. Anyway, well, we move on. Favourite TV programme, Blind Date. Hobbies, Scrabble.
Okay, this has got to help.
Favourite food, Thai.
Oh, well, hang on a minute now. Okay, now this is interesting, because after two clues, I thought I knew it. After the third, I thought, that's just so obvious, because I was going to say, what on earth?
Well, is that your final answer?
Yeah, why not?
It's the correct answer, yeah. I mean, little bit stereotypical.
Yeah, favourite food, Thai.
Well, that's fine. Why shouldn't it be?
Okay, you're from Thailand, but you're a bit more specific than that.
Okay. Well, you're off the... all the same.
I'm off the mark. No, I'm pleased with this. Yeah, this is good stuff. Yeah.
Okay, we move on. Favourite food, Indian.
Nice.
Remember, if you're just tuning in, I don't even know if that works on a podcast, but this is the 1993 top 16 in the World Championship programme, and they're being asked... their favourite thing. So, favourite food, Indian.
Mm-hmm.
Favourite music, Guns N' Roses. Okay. Hobbies, motorcycles.
Okay. If it's motorcycles, I think he was still in the 16 at that time. Then I'm going to say Steve James.
That's correct, yeah. I think that's the one, really, that, you know, it sort of gives it away. But, yeah, he was, of course, big into that. I mean, he had various accidents, didn't he? But
well, he was nearly killed, I think.
There you are. There you are. Funnily enough, I mentioned John Dee. I saw Steve Jones at his funeral. He looks very well, actually, because he'd be 60 now. But
yeah, I think they played on the same team for a while, actually, because John was a very good player. Or maybe he was the manager of the team.
Yeah, anyway, he managed Martin Clark on it and all those sort of people. But, of course, also, we talked about the Crucible Almanac. That's one of the great stats in there. Steve James and Jimmy White shared the same birthday, and they played each other in the semis in 91 on their birthday. Anyway, we move on. So it's 2 out of 3. They're doing well. Okay. Favourite TV programme, Our Wiedersehen Pet. Favourite food, Indian and Cantonese. Most admired, The Pope.
Wow. Oh. Okay. Well, on the basis of the last one, and because I'm fairly sure he would have been the only Roman Catholic in the top 16 at the time. There's a sentence you never expected to hear on the podcast. I'm going to guess Dennis.
Correct. Dennis Taylor. Yeah.
He actually went to... Dennis actually went... You know, there's a Catholic church just across the road from the Crucible. He actually went there on the morning of the final when he won the World Championship.
There we are. Yeah. Okay.
What's so that? Three out of four.
Yeah, that's
I'm very pleased with this. Yeah.
Yeah, you see, we're turning the podcast around. People said, yeah. Anyway. Right, next we move on. Here we go. Favorite TV program, sports. It says sports programs. I think that's supposed to be programs. It's a bit late to correct it. Favorite food, Indian. Doesn't give much away. Favorite music, okay, and this is quite expansive. Elvis Costello, Morrissey, and Roger Waters.
Wow.
So someone who likes music, anyway.
Yeah. Elvis Costello, Morrissey, and Roger Waters. Good selection, that.
They're sort of anti-Dire Straits. That. Although I quite like Dire Straits. But anyway.
Yeah. I am going to say Willie Thorne.
No, it's Neil Foles.
Really?
Yes, it is.
Yeah, actually, do you know what? I should have got that one because I know he was a massive music fan.
Well, I could have said hobbies, greyhound racing and watching cricket, but then you would have got it then.
Oh, I definitely would have got it then.
Yes. Yeah. Of course, these days it's all Neutral Milk Hotel and all that stuff. But anyway, that's in those days, that was an avant-garde response, that Elvis Costello, Morrissey and Roger Waters. Let's move on. Okay. Right. Favourite food, Marmite.
Good work.
Favorite colour, Beamish. Favorite TV program, Rosie and Jim.
Actually, I have to say it's ironic. I've only got two wrong so far. One of them is, of all these 16, the one I know by far the best.
Favorite food, Marmite. Favorite colour, Beamish. Favorite TV program, Rosie and Jim.
Is it Steve?
It is Steve. Steve hates questionnaires.
Yes.
We'll not take them seriously, but yes, but you divine that.
Yeah. Now, I think I actually remember reading that Rosie and Jim answer. Yeah.
Favorite TV program, Bread, Cheers.
Now, sorry. Yeah. Can I just say Steve did manage to barge his way through the field a number of times, so it's appropriate like Rosie and Jim. Sorry,
don't need to say that. Favorite TV program, which is Bread, Cheers. Of course, that could be the answer to favorite food, but Bread and Cheers, your favorite TV programs. Favorite music, funk and soul. Hobbies, a lot of things here. Watching football, horse racing, golf, collecting black and white movies.
What, Dominic? No, he wasn't in the 16 then. Can you give me the first clues again there? What were they?
Yeah. Favourite TV programme, Bread and Cheers. Okay. Favourite music. Fun football, horse racing, collecting black and white movies.
Football, horse racing. Oh, is it? Now, was he in the top 16 then? Surely not. No, I'm thinking of someone here, but no, I don't think he was still in the top 16. So, do you know what? I'm going to say it anyway, just because. Was it John Virgo?
No, it was John Parrott.
I was going to say that until you said collecting black and white movies.
Well, the clues are there. Bread, obviously, Liverpool. Sitcom, horse racing's in there, golf, anyway.
But that's exactly it. That's why I was going to say him. But then I thought, John Parra collects black and white movies.
I don't know whether anyone's still keeping score or not. Let's do a couple more. Yeah. You know, this when this is on ITV in prime time, people will remember where it started. Right. Okay. Favourite music, Simply Red. Favourite food, Chinese and Italian. Favourite TV programme, Whose Line Is It Anyway?
Yeah. So that's it.
Right.
Blimey. Favourite music, Simply Red. You sort of feel you should know. All these, like, I would have read this programme, so these things all sound familiar. Whose Line Is It Anyway? I'm trying to think of a snooker player with a good sense of humour. Shouldn't take long to sort through those. I don't know. Nigel Bond?
No, you're relatively close. He's the right sort of same age, I guess. Alan McManus.
Yeah. I should have got that, actually, yeah. Yeah, because Alan does have a very good sense of humour. Yeah.
We'll do two more and then draw a line under it all.
Yeah.
Favourite colour, red.
Simply red.
I don't know why even they asked that. Anyway, favourite colour, red. Favourite TV programme, Casualty. Favourite music, and there's a list here, Genesis, Peter Gabriel and Elton John.
Stephen Hendry.
You've come in very quickly there. It's not Stephen Hendry, but I'll give you another clue. Most admired, my parents, particularly my mother. That's not my mother. It's the person who's been asking the.
I'll tell you what. I'm gonna guess Willie Thorne again.
It's not. It's Darren Morgan. Yeah.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Last one. People will say, "Thank goodness."
Yes.
Okay. Right. Okay. Most admired: Ivan Lendl, Steve Davis, and Nick Faldo. Favorite food? All. Now this is the probably the answer of the whole thing. Favorite food? All except sea slugs. Okay. Favourite TV programme, Frank Sidebottom and The Shed Show.
My word.
So we've got Ivan Lendl, Steve Davis and Nick Faldo, most of mine. Favourite food, all except sea slugs. Favourite TV programme, Frank Sidebottom and The Shed Show.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of a player who would have been in the top 16 at that time. Like tennis.
Can I just say, while you're thinking of the answer... Nick and Phil from Talking Snooker have Sean Murphy on this week. Here's us reading questionnaires from the 93 World Championship programme. We've got to up our game anyway. Let's see if you can at least end on a high by getting the answer.
I really don't know. Gary Wilkinson?
Correct!
There we go. By a process of elimination, really, because...
Well, I'll tell you what, let's just do a little twist on it, okay? I'll give you the player, and you see if you can guess what the answers are. Okay, so I'm going to give you Stephen Hendry.
Okay, if I get even one of these right, I'll be absolutely astonished.
Well, Stephen Hendry's hobbies in 1993 is listed two.
Right. Well, winning the World Championship. And what? And winning the UK Championship. Yeah. The Masters, yeah. Two. Well, golf. Come on, golf's got to be one. Yeah. And is he going to say something like eating out?
No, music. So yeah.
I was going to say that then.
Favorite music is listed two bands here.
It's Phil Collins. No, Phil Collins isn't a band. I just remember him talking once about Phil Collins. So two bands. Stephen Hendry. So 1993. I'm trying to think of bands that might have been big. U2.
Surprisingly not. Actually, no. I thought they would have been in there, but no.
Were they bands that were big at that time?
Oh yes, very much so.
Okay, right. That's good. So Guns N' Roses.
No.
Nirvana?
Nope. Just a reminder, everyone, Vanilla Icy Shergar podcast is still available if you're not enjoying this.
Yeah. Okay. Oh, go on. Give me the nationality of one of the bands, even.
Well, one's been mentioned already. British...
Simply Red?
Yes. And the other one... They were around the sort of grunge movement. They weren't really grunge, but they became a massive stadium band.
So grunge movement, but...
Well, they were from that whole scene, but they sort of broke out of that scene, I suppose.
Yeah, I don't know. Pearl Jam?
R.E.M. Yeah.
R.E.M., okay. Yeah. What did R.E.M. have to do with grunge?
Well, no, they were around that whole scene, weren't they, I think.
What does that mean? They were around that whole scene. This is the worst quiz ever. This is dreadful. This actually reminds me, I've got to mention this. Funny, I was only thinking about this, I think it was today or yesterday, how on a radio show that I did the sport on many, many years ago, they had a competition. They used to come up with some bizarre ideas for competitions. But one of them was a true or false thing where they would give you a subject and they'd read out a series of statements and you had to tell them which of those statements were false. So if you thought they'd say a statement that was false, you'd say false. And if you were right, you got a point. But if you were wrong, you didn't lose anything. And there was nothing for saying it was true. So pretty quickly the contestants cottoned on that if you just said false to everything, you'd get the maximum number of points. And this dragged on for a few days until someone sort of wisely thought of changing the format. But I think we may have come up with an even worse quiz format.
Speaking of dragging on, yeah, I mean, R.E.M., mm-hmm. a lot of people are losing their religion as we speak. But anyway, yes, we'll do two more. I'll give you Jimmy White. So Jimmy White's, in 1993, he's listed two hobbies. Don't say losing, Will Fine.
That's cruel.
That's cruel.
Literally what I was going to say. Two hobbies in 1993 for Jimmy. I guess. There's all sorts of answers.
They're both sports. They're both sports.
Well, horse racing, surely.
Yeah.
And golf?
Yes.
Okay.
Favorite music is listed a singer and a band.
Is the singer a man or a woman?
A man. We're one step away from sounds like, aren't we?
Yeah, indeed. from what nationality? British or American?
British, yeah.
Well,
yeah.
Give me a clue. Come on, there's so many.
He's now an aging rocker. He's a well-known guitarist.
Eric Clapton,
and the band you should get really, I think. Jimmy White. Well, Jimmy White's favourite band has got to be. It can only be one, can't there?
Really?
Well, he's literally best friends with one of them.
Oh, right, okay. Yeah, the Rolling Stones. Eric Clapton, I have to say, I went to see him in concert about 10 years ago. And around the same time, I saw Elbow. Both of them were very, very good. And even though I wouldn't be a major fan of either of them, but they both gave a good concert. But Guy Garvey, the singer of Elbow, he almost ruined his own concert by just talking too much in between the songs. There was almost as much of that as there was of the songs themselves. When I went to see Eric Clapton, he literally walked on the stage, waved, sat down, played his songs, stood up at the end, and waved again. Not a word out of him other than that.
Well, that's probably that's a good reason for that, because he once said something really appalling on stage, which he still follows him around to this day. We'll move on. Anyway, we'll move on. So, in 1993, Jimmy White's favourite TV programme.
Well, come on, again, I need a clue here.
It was a sitcom. Okay.
British, American?
Yeah, British. It featured the people in it arguably are better known for being in a different sitcom.
Oh. In 1993? What channel would it have been on? BBC or ITV?
I think it was a BBC Two show.
BBC Two, a sitcom in 1993, and the people in it were better known for being in a previous show? Or?
Yeah.
Nothing's coming to mind. Oh, what? 1993. You're gonna have to give me another clue there.
Well, one of the characters, I think, if memory serves, was called Eddie Hitler.
So Bottom.
Yes, yeah. Rick Mayall and Adrian Edmondson. Yeah. Okay, we're going to end this with the one last one, and if you get any of these, then a prize will be forthcoming, because we're going to go to Alain Robidoux. Okay, who? Most admired. Who did Alain Robidoux most admire? It's not a snooker player. In 1993, is a sportsman. But,
sportsman. Yeah. What? Going to tell me what sport? Hang on, no, don't. I'm going to make a guess. Wayne Gretzky.
No. Oh. It's a golfer.
Golfer. In 1993, Greg Norman.
Nope.
Faldo Seve.
Nope.
Oh, I don't know. It wouldn't have been a Canadian player because they didn't have any leading players.
I think, if I'm right, that he'd won the Augusta Masters at this point.
Had he won it that year?
I'm going to look that up actually. You're not doing anything else, are we? Let's have a look.
Freddie Couples?
Correct, yeah.
Okay, now he'd won it the year before.
Yeah, well, there we are. Right. So, yeah, it's a reason to admire him. Okay, I promise you we'll finish this soon. Hobbies, he's actually listed three hobbies. In fact, I'm just going to tell you because badminton, golf, and watching television, but favourite music, okay? Two singers and a band have been listed here. It's all the same sort of people, I notice, actually.
Right.
It's all the same ballpark. Yeah.
Some clues then?
The singer had been in a well-known band and then had a very successful solo career. He also had what you could argue was the best video of the 80s, maybe.
Peter Gabriel?
Correct.
Yeah.
The next one is from your neck of the woods.
What, a band?
No, he's a singer. Yeah.
Singer? Van Morrison?
No.
To think of, so a solo singer, a man or a woman?
A man. He had one particularly big hit, a sort of soupy ballad.
And he's Irish.
Yeah, I think
Johnny Logan.
No, Chris de Burgh.
Yeah. Oh, okay. I wouldn't have got that.
A band. Well, actually, the band featured one of the people Neil Foles chose.
I've forgotten who they are now. So okay. So he said Elvis Costello, and. Who were the other two, he said?
Well, if I tell you that, you'll get them, won't you?
Yeah, that's why I want you to tell me.
I may as well, because that will bring this to an end. Morrissey. Yeah.
Oh, the Smiths, yes.
Yeah, but it's not. Yeah. But that's not the answer.
Oh, and right, sorry.
Roger Waters.
Oh, okay, so Pink Floyd.
Yeah.
There we go.
Well, there we are. So, listen, it's not been... The episode's not over yet, though. So the good news is we have got Wayne Griffiths on, hopefully, if I could edit the two interviews together. You wanted to say something about Wayne, I think.
No, just when you mentioned he was going to be on, it reminded me there was a tournament in the 1980s, and it was a father and son event, and Steve played in it with his dad, Bill, and Neil played in it with his dad, Jeff. Now, you might spot a flaw in this format here, but Terry played in it with Wayne, and Dennis played in it with one of his sons, and it was sponsored by Pirelli, who I think were they made shoes or whatever, so it was a father and son event. But obviously, it was a massively flawed event because you've got two pros there playing together, and all the rest are a pro and a not particularly high-ranking amateur. So inevitably, Neil and Jeff won it. So yeah, I wonder if Wayne remembers playing in that. I'm sure he does. I don't think it was on TV or anything, but I think it was played in front of a crowd.
Well, just to say about if you think the podcast has been a difficult listen so far. The interview, Wayne was very interesting, talking about snooker quotient, but the one word of warning, I'm in the UK, he's in Hong Kong. A couple of times the connection did drop out. Hopefully, you can get all the relevant information. And he does have a website, whatisyoursq.com. That's whatisyoursq.com, which contains all the information you need if you're interested in this. It's a snooker handicapping system, as you'll find out. But a couple of times we do slightly lose each other. It's been that sort of show, hasn't it? But next week we may have a special guest. I'm not going to say any more on that. We're hopeful, and it's a big name, believe me. We're going to be right back in business next week if this comes off. If it doesn't, then we'll be...
I think you're slightly overplaying our hand there on two grounds. One, we haven't even asked him yet.
True.
And two, you know, with the greatest of respect, I think you're overselling him just a little. But let's put it this way. Regular listeners to the podcast will greatly enjoy having this person on. Seems remarkable we're talking about. We haven't even asked him yet.
I'm hopeful. If not, then we're going to be reduced to making up anagrams of players' names or something like that to fill the time. But anyway, despite all of that, we are still members of the Sports Social Network. They'll probably kick us out after this week. You can check out their other podcasts, of course, and you can email us. And please do, otherwise we'll have nothing to talk about. snookerscenepodcast@mail.com. That's snookerscenepodcast@mail.com. If you've been thinking, oh, there's no point, I won't read it out, believe me, we will take anything.
After you've heard this week's show, you'll know that the bar is set extremely low.
Well, you know, even you look at the great sort of sitcoms, you know, there's been rotten episodes of Cheers, haven't there? You know, the point is that
not this rotten, though.
We can't summon up gold every week, but do stay with us. Wayne Griffiths is coming up shortly, so it is not technically true to say goodbye-bye. The podcast continues very shortly.
So I'm joined from Hong Kong by Wayne Griffiths. We're going to talk about snooker quotient very soon, Wayne. But first of all, thanks for coming on the podcast. How are you?
I'm well, Dave. Thanks very much for having me on the podcast. It's a great honor. I listen to it an awful lot from here in over in Hong Kong. Very pleased to be a part of it. You're doing a great job.
Thank you very much. Well, we'll get on, as I say, to SQ later, but you've got an interesting snooker background because, of course, you grew up very much in a snooker house. Your father is Terry Griffiths, the great Terry Griffiths, former world champion, one of the great players of the 80s and 90s. So snooker was, I guess, in your blood right from the start.
Yes, we were a sporting family, I guess, and Dad obviously reaching the pinnacle of his sport allowed us to move to a house that had a snooker table for him to practice on probably when I was about 9 or 10 years old. So, yeah, we were introduced to snooker at that stage, very young, both myself and my brother, Darren. So snooker was, you know, Dad was 1979 world champion, and then from then on, his career lasted 20 years. So snooker was a massive part of our lives, certainly as young players.
And to what extent did you play? I mean, I guess, you know, your dad's a player, there's a table in the house, you're going to play. But did it become something that you necessarily wanted to follow him into? Because it's quite hard, isn't it, when a parent is so successful for the child to sort of, I guess, match that success?
Yeah, I think I have this conversation quite a lot. I certainly played the game just to what you'd call a good club standard, maybe, century break player. Followed in my dad's footsteps of being the youngest ever winner of the sort of local Lethian district tournament, but I didn't follow in dad's footsteps from then on. Neither did my brother. My brother's a teaching professional in golf. He's a director of golf in Monterrey out in Portugal. And I went, football was my passion. I followed that, and snooker was a hobby for me. I'm not quite sure if my brother and I shied away from it because of the shadow that dad's success may have cast. It never felt that way, but maybe it was a part. Dad was very, very clear he didn't want to push us into it, which was good in some ways. But I came back to it later on, enjoyed it a little bit more, and then got back into the coaching side with dad's help as well.
Yeah, I was going to say, obviously you have ultimately stayed in snooker. So how did the sort of coaching side of it start?
I went back to, Dad had a club, the Terry Griffiths Matchroom in Llanelli, and in 2003, Dad was, you know, looking to wind down a little bit. He was busy with the coaching and that sort of thing. So I went back to the club then to help him out there. And really, we wanted to keep a bit of a legacy. We wanted his name to remain in the sport. So we were quite keen to keep the club open. So I left my job at the time and went back into the family business. And the club. To do the PBSA coaching. Back into the coaching that side. And of course, I was working every day with Dad as my mentor. So really fantastic learning opportunity for myself.
And you're now in Hong Kong. How did that come about? It's quite a move, I guess, from, you know, Llanelli to the other side of the world.
Yeah, as you can imagine, a big family decision. Came out of the blue, really, the job offer in 2010. There was the snooker had been reasonably successful here and had got itself to a point where it earned itself enough points to move into the Hong Kong Sports Institute, where they then get funding for travel around the world. The players get paid a grant, and luckily for me, they also employed a head coach. So as part of a search around the world, as it was, they turned me over in Wales, brought me over for an interview. And yeah, I was lucky enough to get the job just before the Asian Games in 2010.
We'll move on to SQ in a moment, I promise. But a lot of people, as you're in Hong Kong, will be interested to know how Marco Fu's getting on, because, of course, we didn't see him at all last season. He couldn't travel because of the pandemic. I think quite rightly, World Snooker Tour giving him a wild card for the new season, but has he been able to sort of play during the last year at all, just even just in sort of practice?
Yeah, Marco is still playing. he's, you know, obviously very pleased that WST and WPBSA have given him a wild card, and he's looking forward to come back onto the tour, hopefully as soon as possible this season. Things have been like all around the world, but Hong Kong has been particularly strict with quarantine and travel. Every trip we apply for, even now, things are getting better, has to be stringently checked from a medical point of view before they will allow us to travel. So yeah, the last year and a half, it's been very difficult for us to get out of Hong Kong because of the COVID situation and the policies in place here to try and keep us all safe. But yes, he's practicing hard and hoping to get back on the tour as soon as possible.
That's good to know. And I suppose pre-COVID, we'll have to say, like, what's the snooker scene like in Hong Kong? I mean, is it sort of a popular sport? There's a lot of people listening, I guess, won't be aware of how snooker is received in various parts of the world. So what's the scene like in Hong Kong?
Yeah, it is a very popular sport here. The success of Marco and Oni as well. In the next year, the success of those two guys has really raised the profile. The fact that they're both very personable, very successful, good figureheads for the sport, that has really piqued the interest here. I think the original boom here in Hong Kong was back in when Barry Hearn came over here in the mid-80s. And that was a real boom. I hear stories of snooker 120 snooker tables and empty list through the 90s. It was really big. Very popular, not so popular now. A lot of it to do the rent is so expensive here that to run a snooker club is very, how can I say, very, very hard to make money. You've got to be really... So the numbers of clubs have gone down since the 90s, but no, they still have a lot of interest here, especially, as you say, with Marco on the main tour.
Yeah, and we should say good luck, obviously, to Onyi as well, because she's coming onto the tour. And one thing you can't fault her for is enthusiasm. She seems to absolutely love the game. She always seems to be smiling and just happy to be sort of pursuing her dream, I guess.
Yes, she is a very positive, hard-working, and she's relishing the chance to have a go on the tour. She knows it'll be a very difficult task for her, but I can assure you she will be as prepared as well as she can be. She'll give everything on the table, and she'll take away everything she can as well in terms of learning and personal growth, I'm sure.
Excellent. Okay, well, so snooker quotient, it's a handicap system in effect. Well, you explain it, Wayne. What is it and how was it developed?
Yeah, the snooker quotient is set up to be a snooker handicap, as you say. It was started, Dad and I were discussing this maybe at least 15 years ago. How can we're having a lot of players in for coaching. How can we grade them now? How can we let them know they're getting stronger? You and everybody listening will be aware that high breaks have been used in the past. You know, are you a century break player? Have you done a maximum? Or is your high break 50? That's what generally was used. But we always felt that, especially my brother was a golfer, right? So we always saw the golf handicap as a real motivator. You know, it allowed people to see exactly where they were now. They knew what a professional standard would be. They knew a single figure handicap golfer would be considered a very good standard. So we saw in golf that people could clearly see how they were getting better from a handicap. And we saw that as maybe a gap in the market or something that could help snooker players. You know, the goal really with the handicap system was to give people more enjoyment so that you'd have more people playing, hopefully, playing more often, so that there'd be more people in clubs. You know, the clubs have had a hard time, especially recently with COVID, and coaching as well. World Snooker have done a lot of good work with coaches. The numbers are up over 400 now around the world, I think. But we're still looking at comparisons with golf, where maybe they've got 29,000 working professionals in the US alone, earning a good living. I'm not sure how many snooker coaches there are earning a good living, but we feel there's some some bridge needs to be built maybe between a very popular TV sport into a participation sport that can be coached and where people can see themselves actually getting better and enjoy the game from that. So that's why we set up the handicap system, to try and serve people all the way from beginner and to professional, so they can see a complete pathway to improvement.
So how does it work? How do you get an SQ handicap?
Basically, on the website, you can download an app on the SQ or whatisyoursq.com website. And with that app, it allows you to do a number of tests. So there are four key skills areas, and that is brick building, cue ball control, long potting, and general skills. So there are tests for each of those key skill sets. And you have to do it through the app, though, Dave. So you can't roll up into the club and do the test and then write us a score down. These tests have to be recorded through the app. And immediately as you record them, then after you submit them, they are submitted to our website cloud, as it were. And every test is verified. So if you do a test and you give a score, that score will be checked, so that everybody that sees that your SQ is maybe 50 can be assured that's been done under the control of the app through a video, and that video has been seen and verified as well. So it's not an honor system. Once you start a test, you have to complete it. So you're under quite a bit of pressure as well. So it's not only a test of your skill, it's a test of your nerve as well.
So in effect, as you said, there's these four key areas, and then they're combined into some sort of algorithm. Is that right? And then you get a score. And is it the case that then maybe a few months down the line, you're tested again to see the extent to which you've improved?
Yeah, certainly. In Hong Kong, do a number of tests per year. I use it for relative assessment amongst the players here in Hong Kong. But yes, for people who want to sign up for the SQ, do the tests as often as they want. We only ask them to do four tests every 2 years.
But right,
you can do a test every week if you want. The way we set this up, we want to encourage coaching. So if you do a long potting test today, you can't do that long potting test for another 7 days. The idea is that you look at what you've done, you reflect on the test, you go and talk to your coach, or you go and practice it, and then you come back at least 7 days later to have another go, rather than just, you know, having a repeat test and repeat tests all the time. It really is set up as an improvement tool.
Now, I'm afraid I slightly lost you, Wayne. Can you still hear me?
Yeah, I got you, but I lost you.
Okay,
for a second.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, obviously you're in Hong Kong. I'm in the UK. We cut out a little bit, but we'll persevere. So I guess is the idea in time that this can be used in tournaments, because snooker handicap is not quite, or so far has not been quite as sophisticated as the golf handicap. You know, in a handicap event, say there are pros in it, then the amateurs get whatever, 14 start, 21 start, whatever. But this seems slightly more complex. And is the idea that, you know, you can use this to sort of grade players in tournaments?
Yes, for sure. I mean, we've collected 10 years of data on the system already here in Hong Kong. And, you know, we've been fortunate enough to set up a coaching partnership now with the WPBSA. To take this out into the wider world, as it were. So yes, it's definitely set up in the future to have like an SQ handicap calculator. So you would put in your SQ, I would put my SQ in, and we would generate what would be a correct number of points that one player would give another to make that a level playing field, as you do in golf. So as well as being a training tool, a development tool, so that you can see, are you a beginner? Are you an intermediate? Are you a club international, top amateur, professional player? Where are you? Where does your SQ put you in that scale? As well as doing that for training, it will allow people to play on a level playing field in the future as well. Also, certainly that's our goal anyway.
Yeah. And of course, in golf, The idea is obviously to get your handicap down to become a scratch golfer. So is there a certain number that can be aimed at under this system, this handicap system?
Yeah, there certainly is. It ranges from 0 to 100. So there's a wide range. Most people would sit between 10 and 80, I guess. So the beginners, anybody can do this SQ test, even if you're a beginner. You'd be in the low digits, but yes, you'd want to improve. So we're moving the opposite way to golf. As your SQ gets higher, then your game would be deemed to be better. So as your SQ creeps up, yeah, there's certainly at each stage we can see, you know, for a top amateur or a professional, you'd need to be much closer to 100 than a beginner, obviously. But nobody can get 100. The test is set up so that's everybody can strive to continually improve. It's not a destination, 100. You won't get there. It will really be an improvement journey for whoever takes it up. But on the website, yes, people can see what we would expect that a professional would need to achieve in terms of an SQ.
And I guess for a coach such as yourself, it's a good way of tracking improvement in players, because, you know, you can sort of from the naked eye think, OK, well, he's potting more long ones than he used to be, or she's, you know, sort of making higher breaks than she was. But actually, this is a way of tracking it and for the players to track it as well, to track the way they're improving or hopefully improving.
Yes, that's certainly how we've used it here in Hong Kong. We've had players start at 11 years old, go on to be world junior champions and challenge tour winners, and are nudging, pushing on to the main tour now. And yes, you can see a development profile emerge that is, as you said, not based on subjectivity or just the naked eye. It's actually based on hard facts. The SQ is taken down to 2 decimal points, and you can clearly see if you're improving or you're not. And a little bit different to the golf as well, in that with the 4 areas of long potting, break building, cue ball control and general skills, it not only shows you your overall SQ, but it actually targets areas for you and your coach where you can see that you're behind the curve. So certain areas may be strong where other areas are weak. So then you can be more efficient in targeting your improvement plans.
Mm. And it should be said as well, this is being supported by some big names, some global ambassadors. Obviously, Terry, we've got Steve Davis, Cliff Thorburn, Kelly Fisher, Ong Yi, Marco. So clearly there's a sort of global dimension to this as well. I mean, obviously, I know you're in Hong Kong, but a lot of people listening to this probably UK-based. But this is something you want to roll out across the world.
Definitely. One of the goals, as I said, was more players playing more often in more clubs with more coaches. And that is, I mean, UK, we're a bit spoiled. A lot of good players, a lot of good clubs, good coaching, a lot of good players to play against each other. So the improvement is there. But in a number of other countries, Dave, I know you put this podcast out to a lot of countries where, you know, they're younger in terms of snooker. Maybe they haven't got the structure, but they've definitely got the passion, the interest and the talent to bring players into the game. So definitely SQ wants to bring more countries involved, bring more countries, getting players to the main tour. We're going to have something called the Path to Professional that we're going to roll out with national governing bodies, possibly. And we're very lucky, as you mentioned, some of those names. Dad obviously kicked this off and back in the day and is running with it now. But Steve Davis, yeah, Cliff Thorburn, Kelly Fisher, Marco Onni, PJ Nolan, Mohammed Shihab out in the Middle East, all these good people, all, I should add, freely giving their support to what they feel is a system that could really be a game changer.
OK, well, there's much more information, of course, on the website, which is whatisyoursq.com. That's whatisyoursq.com. The connection is just about holding out, but I don't want to risk it too much more, Wayne, so I'm going to wrap up there. But I wish you all the best with it. It's clear a lot of thought's gone into it. And it's something that snooker's never really had, this sort of system, like, as you say, in golf. So I suppose, finally, how do you see it sort of developing over the next few years? Hopefully, I suppose, from your point of view, players will embrace it.
Well, we really hope so. It's an opportunity. You know, it's going to be a little bit of a slow burner. It is a big change. You know, a lot of information for people to take on. But with the good people we are working with, yeah, we really believe over the next year or two, as it builds momentum, more players get involved, we have more data, more stories, it will start to market itself, you know, and be something that hopefully a snooker player, every snooker player is asking, you know, what is your SQ when they're asking another player. And following on from that, Kelly Fisher with a link is that we will move from snooker into other Q sports, 8-ball and 9-ball pool with a similar system in the future. So, yeah, the future is definitely exciting, but it'll take a little bit of time for us to make sure that everybody understands what we're trying to achieve.
Brilliant. Okay, well, I wish you all the best with it, Wayne, and thanks so much for being on the podcast.
Really appreciate your time, Dave. Great podcast. Thank you very much.
Thanks. Sports Social Podcast Network.